Well, hello and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to demystify death a bit, but also talk about loss and how to get over loss and how to get on with a good life after you've suffered some losses. And I came across my next guest, Lee Wakeham, at the Co-op AGM, where he was demonstrating his pasties, which is part of a company he's founded called HM Pasties. And the Co-op are supporting him in that. And we'll talk about that a bit later. But I was really interested to talk to you further, Lee, about your life, because I know you've suffered a lot of losses along the way. Do you want to tell me where you'd like to begin?
It all starts a very, very long time ago, really, at the age of two, when my mum left me with her friend and went off to Portsmouth with my one-year-old brother. And didn't return, and I was then put into foster care and remained in foster care until leaving care when I was just before my first prison sentence, when I was about 17 years old. My mum did turn up when I was about 15, just about to sit my GCSEs, and I also found out when I was 11 that my brother that she'd left with, he was adopted. And then she had another child while she was in Portsmouth. So I've got one brother that's a year younger than me, another one that's 2 years younger than me, and they were both adopted. So, and I think of all the things that have happened in my life, the thing that I still feel a little bit angry about is I'll never be able to find those two brothers. And because of decisions that were made by other people. But as I know now, to be very selfish reasons, I've essentially grown up on my own and experienced an awful time in foster care, physical, sexual, emotional, financial abuse throughout my time in care, which I ran away from when I was 14 and moved in with a second set of foster parents who were amazing. And unfortunately, just last week, my foster father, Brian, died. I only found out, he died on Tuesday, found out about that on Thursday. And whilst I've been expecting it for a while, it's still really, really upsetting. And that really is just a snapshot, really, of the life I had probably up until being about 15, 16 when I met my mum. That destroyed my foster placement because I wanted to be with my mum. And my mum had, I had a younger brother who was 5 at the time and a sister that was 3 and another sister that was 2. And I met my uncle and I had cousins, young cousins. They were all a lot younger than me. And I so desperately wanted to be part of that. And my foster parents are like, just take it slow. Just take it slow, slow down, slow down. But I've been waiting for this all my life. Mm. And jumped in 2 feet first, and it lasted about 6 weeks, really, before I had a big falling out with my mum and ended up back with my foster parents. But by that time, my mum ran a house very different from my foster parents, and she let me drink, she let me go out clubbing at 16 years old, and they're like, no, we're not having any of that. So I started rebelling against them and ended up in a flat on my own just before my 17th birthday. And then 9 months later, I was in jail for the first time. Because I was living on £33.50 a week. In spite of everything, I'd done well at school. So I was doing A-levels. So I was trying to do A-levels, trying to feed, clothe, and entertain myself on £33.50 a week. Gosh. Of which I had to pay £7.50 for my electric, £5 to top up my rent. So that left me £20 a week to live on, which went a bit further back in the early 90s than it does today. But it still wasn't enough for me to get to and from college, for me to buy books, for me to buy food, TV license, to go out with my friends, to clothe myself. It just wasn't enough. And that's really when my crime started. It started with stealing to survive, like stealing shopping and things like that. And then I got banned from all the shops. I couldn't steal shopping anymore. I'd walk in there, they're like, no, you get out. And then I needed to find money another way. So that's when I started stealing from people, and little by little my crime escalated to a point where I ended up in jail for a string of street robberies, where I was just robbing people in the street to get things that I could sell and to get money to go and buy food and, to be honest, to carry on going out drinking with my friends.
You've talked a lot about what happened along the way, but you haven't really talked about your feelings. I mean, what on earth was it like to be abandoned at two? And did you feel sort of sad or angry during your first 14, 15, 16 years?
Do you know, I felt angry all the time. All the time. And that's why I was largely getting into a lot of trouble. Because it wasn't just stealing. I was drinking and getting into a lot of fights, a lot of violence from the moment I ended up in a flat on my own. I mean, there was violence already, because when I was at school, I was fighting all the time. If someone said something I didn't like in school, I'd just walk up to them and hit them. And it wasn't really until much later in life when I really started to understand why. And that was when I had counselling every week through my second prison sentence to try and work out why I felt the way that I did. I felt angry all the time. But when I was drunk, I let go of that anger. And would let go of that anger on anyone that happened to cross my path. And it was through counselling. I mean, I kind of thought it was linked to me being sexually abused and abused by my foster parents, but I didn't think it would. I had no idea around attachment theory and things like that, and how being abandoned at two, from that point, that's impacted on my psychological well-being, really, and the development of my brain. So I understand a lot more about that now than I did when I was younger. In understanding that and working through all the abuse and things like that in therapy, I just don't have that anger anymore. Pleased to say it's gone. It left me a long time ago. But yeah, I was a very, very, very angry young man. And so everyone kept saying, you've got anger management problems. And it was the first person who actually said anything differently was my barrister when I was looking at my second prison sentence, when he said, why are you doing this? You're an intelligent guy. You've got a lot going for you. Why are you behaving like this? And when I told him about my upbringing, and he went, I get it. He said, I can see why you're angry, but what you're doing with that anger is completely unacceptable. And it, for the first time, someone told me I had every right to be angry, instead of telling me you've got anger management problems. And that was a light bulb moment that.
So interesting what you say, and I guess what you say is replicated a lot around the country and around all the young people who end up in prison, just as you did.
Yeah. I mean, our prison is overpopulated, but it's largely populated by people who have experienced trauma in their early life, whether that's the type of abuse that I've experienced, or watching their parents knock lumps out of each other on a daily basis, or dad just getting up and leaving, or dad not being part of their life, which is a really common statistic for people in prison. But care leavers are massively overrepresented in the prison system. I think it's 25% of the prison population are care leavers, but only 1% of the population have ever been in care. So it's something wrong with the whole, whether it's, yes, you're traumatized by being in care and you're damaged by that, but then the whole leaving care process is flawed. You know, I was sent out on my own into the world at 17 years old with £430 to build a life on, with no one to call back on when things started to go wrong. And things haven't changed a great deal between the early 90s and now.
That's so bad, isn't it? I remember seeing on television a story of a young girl who wanted to go to university, couldn't afford a laptop. She just left care. She couldn't afford a laptop. Yeah. What was she going to do?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, there were times when I got big bills that came through. You know, so my credit rating was absolutely written off at the age of 17. Even before I could really get any proper credit, my credit rating was completely destroyed, because there were bills that I just could not afford to pay. So I started getting CCJ, and started getting defaults and things like that. And so that, you know, if you, I'd love to see the percentage of care leavers that are able to get on the property ladder. Mm. And if they do, when are they able to get on the property ladder? Because I would be very surprised if many of them could do it much before their mid to late 30s. You know, you're a good 10 years behind your peers, I would say, when you're leaving care. And that's without going to prison, you know. Really are disadvantaged.
It's so sad, because it's the people who need love and care most of all, isn't it, who are just getting stuffed, basically.
Yeah, I think in my childhood I probably felt loved and cared for a two-year period.
Gosh.
And that was when I moved in with my second foster parents. prior to that, I was terrified. I didn't want to be at home. I was scared to do anything wrong because I knew if they found out, I would get an absolute beating. I went to school every single day, but when I got to school, I just created Mary Helen School. You know, if that were the case today, the safeguard in leaving the school would be, what's up with this kid? He's never truant. He's never late. He clearly wants to be here, but when he is here, his behaviour is completely unacceptable. Someone would take a look at that and want to know what's going on. And if they'd got me on the right day, I may well have told. I never told social services about the sexual abuse. I only told them about the physical assaults. And it took me a long time to work through the sexual abuse. It really did. But fortunately, I was really like years ahead of most male survivors. Most male survivors don't disclose about abuse for, I think, about 35 years. You know, I disclosed about it when I was 20. And I think that's why my life and how I managed to turn my life around by starting to work on that at a very young age. I came out of prison the second time, almost ready to move on with my life and take advantage of any opportunities that I was able to generate for myself, and managed to get a job a day after leaving prison. And it's kind of my journey in that job that leads to what I do today, because they were a really supportive employer. They didn't know I'd been to jail. I applied for a recruitment agency. I didn't tick the box to say that I'd been to jail. Started work as a production operative the day after, earning £3.25 an hour, putting screws into floodlights, cutting my hands on the aluminium and all that on a regular basis. But then heard that they just fired someone in the office. It was a data entry guy. And I'd done a computer literacy course in prison. So I went in and asked them for that job. And they gave me the job on a 2-week trial basis. I secured that job and got my first ever full-time salary at 25 years old. It was about 12 and a half grand at the time, which again was a lot more money than it is today. And over 18 months, I progressed from being data entry clerk to doing telephone sales, processing orders, to ultimately moving to London as a regional trainee sales manager within 18 months of getting out of jail, earning more money than I could ever imagined. I had a company car, for freedom than I could ever imagined, and I messed that up big time. The money went to my head, the freedom went to my head. I'd never had anything like that before. And you hear of all the mistakes that Premier League footballers make when they strike it big. For me, I'd struck it big, and ended up crashing my company car. Fell asleep at the wheel on the M5. On my way back from Cornwall, but I was doing 1500 miles a week as a learner, basically just past driver, but should have had a green badge on there. And then moved back up to Greater Manchester from London, and I got a job working for Barclays of all places. Again, didn't tick the box. Got a job there, worked there for 4 years. Was one of their top performing sales advisors across, I think, about 4,500 people in the call centers at that time. And then left there because they decided to outsource their call centers. They stopped recruiting, stopped letting people get promoted. So I left and ended up working in recruitment and continuing my sales career. And in 2011, quit my recruitment job just before Christmas. Because I wanted to do something helping people like me that had done some really, really bad things, but for a better start in life, would not have been in that position. And that's when I started working with ex-offenders in 2011.
So we haven't really yet talked about your experience in prison, but I guess it was your experience in prison that led you to want to work with ex-offenders, was it? To give them a chance?
I would say on the second sentence, yes. On the first one, no. The first one, it was a Young Offenders Institute and you did nothing but fight every single day. I got set on fire in the TV room. It was the first prison sentence was awful. You were locked up for 23 hours a day. the hour a day where you were out, you pretty much spent that fighting or queuing up to get your canteen. So the first one, I just came out of that a lot more angry, really. But the second prison sentence, I met a lot of older people in that one, people who had done wanted to do their time and get out and get on with their lives. And I think having lived that life, when you hear a story and what you're hearing is largely a circumstantial event. So something's happened in someone's life that's led them to do something, they've made a mistake, and they paid very, very dearly for it. I can see how that can happen. But most people who haven't lived that life think it's excuses. There's always something you could have done. You didn't have to do that. There was an alternative. But what alternatives are there for me? So me, for example, what alternative was there for me that I knew about other than going and stealing shops and fighting to resolve my anger? Is when I did anything wrong when I was a kid, I got beaten up by my foster parents, by my foster brothers, by my foster sister even, because I was the youngest of six. So the choices that were available to me are based on the things that I learned growing up as a child, which was nothing but abuse. Fortunately, there were no drugs in my household. They were massively anti-drugs. So I didn't deal with my trauma through drugs. I dealt with my trauma through violence, because that's what I've learned. And when all you've learned throughout your upbringing is destructive, you are more than likely going to have destructive coping mechanisms when you're dealing with or when you're processing all that growing up. And young men, they get criminalized at a very young age for that. When a young woman does it, there's a lot of services put around her. She's quite vulnerable, and they do everything they can to avoid sending a young woman to prison. And because girls and boys are all traumatized when they're younger, but our prison system has only got about 5% females in it. The rest are all men, and largely all men that have been traumatized as much as young women and girls, but they're criminalized at a young age because they're just seen as bad, bad lads. And often do commit more serious offences, but they are criminalised at a very, very young age when the crimes are quite minor. And you're told, as you're growing up, if you break the law, you're done for. You're never going to get a job. No one's going to touch you with a barge pole. So as soon as you get convicted of a crime when you're younger, you think that's it.
So when did you have your light bulb moment that made you want to employ ex-offenders and run a business?
So that was, so part of my journey of working with ex-offenders as a resettlement worker, as an employment coach, I kept just seeing the same problem. Guys and girls coming out of prison, wanting to work, either not ready to work or unable to secure a job. And even the ones that do secure a job aren't necessarily ready for it, and they lose that job again quite quickly. So there's this whole, it's a mess, really. You know, you're finding people coming out of work, coming out of prison, getting a job, losing the job quite quickly. They then get sanctioned, so they can't claim the benefits anymore. So they now have no income. But what they know how to solve that problem is to commit crime. So before you know it, they're back out committing crime and back in prison again. So I'm thinking this, there has to be a solution to this, because if you want to work, then there has to be a support mechanism to gear you up to get you ready for work, rather than chuck you in at the deep end. Because most employers, they're not social workers. They don't want your baggage brought to the door. They want you to come to work, do a job, get paid and go home and have no nonsense. And all the work I'd previously done had been funded by the National Lottery, by charitable trusts and things like that. And so you do a piece of work with someone, there's a payment linked to getting that person into job, or through a payment by results or funding bid. So you are kind of targeted to get that person into work very, very quickly. So I thought, well, if we want to do this in a more sustainable way, why don't we try and raise our own funds through selling something and using the profits from what we're selling to do the work that I want to do? And as long as I can continue selling that thing, I can continue to work that I want. And I don't have to do it in a way that I'm told to do it by the Ministry of Justice or by probation or anything. I can do it the way that I want to do it And that is, it's not going to take me 3 months to get this person into work or ready for work. It might take me 12 months. It might take me 18 months. But as long as I can keep selling things, I can keep that person employed for that length of time. And they're going to stay engaged with me as well because they're getting paid for it. And all I knew how to do was make a good Cornish pasty. Well, I say that's all I knew how to do. It was the only thing that I knew I knew I could make a good Cornish pasty, and I knew there wasn't a good Cornish pasty off it because I'm from the Southwest. So there was a gap in the market. There was a need for me to get good Cornish pasties, and I thought, well, let's make them, sell them, use profits for that. And that's really how the business was born. I was sat at home one day thinking, what are we going to call it? And I think, well, what do we do? Well, we hand make pasties. Oh, that's HMP. And that was it. That's how the name of the business came, literally in 20, 30 seconds. The HMP, or HM Pasties, is for handmade pasties.
It's a great name, isn't it?
It tells you what we do. Mm. It tells you what we do straight away. And people make a joke, but they go, well, used to go, Her Majesty's Pasties or His Majesty's Pasties. They know what we do straight away. And it's a brand name that we can build on.
So you've exemplified what I said at the beginning, really, about how people manage to make a success out of big losses. You had the enormous losses, and you've ended up doing things for other people, but also making a great success of your own life, haven't you?
I have, and I think for my own sanity, I had to do something to make it all, I'm not sure worthwhile is the right word, but to make it all make sense, that journey had to happen for me to do what I do now. And had that not happened, then HM Pasties wouldn't exist. The opportunity to create people in prison wouldn't exist. And it makes it all make sense.
And is it purely ex-offenders that you work with, or do you have a mixture of people?
No, we did try that. And we employ people whose lives are quite often fairly chaotic outside of work. And if our business was built 100% around that, as did happen on a number of occasions, I've come into work and I'm the only person there. And the more you grow and the more our customers depend on having our product, the less I could take that risk. And also, being fair to the people we take on from prison, they're not ready to come into work and have all the pressures of being the business. So we created a core team of people who stay with the business for quite a long time, hopefully, and we can slot in people leaving prison in around the core team so that, you know, if they don't turn up to work, we're still going to be able to send our pies to Joe's Box. We're still going to be able to buy the co-op. You know, it'd be no good me saying to the co-op, can't have any pies this week because so-and-so's not turned off work. So at any one time, 25% of our workforce will be people who have either recently left prison or are still in prison and come out on day release. And as we grow, jobs we create will be sexier jobs, for want of a better phrase. So it doesn't all have to be standing in there filling pies. We had a lady recently doing our bookkeeping for us. She's now gone on doing some bookkeeping elsewhere. Delivery drivers is the one that's probably difficult to get people into because it's difficult to get insurance when you've got criminal convictions. But I see no reason why back office jobs, sales jobs, customer service jobs, picking and packing jobs, all sorts of jobs rather than hands-on production.
And it works, obviously. It works for them and it works for you.
It does. I mean, it works for us. In many ways, really, it one of the good things is it opens doors that otherwise would not be open. Businesses out there are crying out to work with socially led businesses, and it's it works. Most of our business, I know, they would not buy from us if we weren't doing what we do.
Gosh, that's really interesting, isn't it? So there is a need for more and more companies like yours then, isn't there, clearly?
Absolutely, yeah. It gets your foot in the door, but your product and your service have got to back it up. They're not going to cut you any slack because you employ ex-offenders. They're not going to you're not going to pay more for it because you employ ex-offenders. The way they see it is they're giving you this opportunity because you employ ex-offenders, and that's the end of the credit we're going to give you. But other than that, we're going to treat you as a as any other supplier, which is fine because I don't want any real favors other than getting the foot in the door. Our product stands up for itself.
So tell me now about your involvement with the co-op. I know you're on the apiary scheme. Could you just describe what that is?
Yeah, so it's a program set up to support mission-led micro to small businesses to be onboarded and start supplying the co-op. It's been a very, very interesting journey because I was anti doing retail. I'm like, no, not doing retail, don't want to do it. But I always thought if I ever did it, it would be co-op. Because in my recruitment days, when I recruited for accountants, the co-op were one of my biggest customers. I was on the third supplier list. And I just knew about your values, and I knew the co-op were the right retailer for us to work with. And like us, we want to make a profit, but our purpose is as important, if not more important. And I would say the same for the co-op. And when I met Kelly Orne, she's like, you have to apply. And I'm like, I'm not sure I really want to do retail. She's like, yeah, but you have to apply. We're not going to treat you like everyone else. We'll look after you. And she's been absolutely true to her word. And we've gone now from basically being a food service business where we just put pies in a brown cardboard box and ship them out. We've developed some really, really nice looking retail packaging. And yeah, we launch in store, I think on the 15th of October. So our journey's been a bit longer than all the other apiary businesses. A lot of them are geared up and ready to be retail. They're just looking for a foot into retail. We were doing everything to not do retail and had a long, long way to go. And now I can't wait to see our products on the shelf. It's going to be awesome.
It's very exciting, and hopefully it will give your business a bit more what's the word I'm looking for? People will get to know your business a bit better. And I hope other people see it as a good example of a way to go.
Well, I think they will. And we've got a couple of amazing things launching in the next few weeks and months. So we've just secured a Liverpool football club. So we are, along with one other pie company, supplying the full stadium with their pies. So we think it's going to be about 5,000 pies per game. Wow. So we've got that starting at the end of July, co-op launching in October. We've just secured a listing with a local food service company, Dunster's Farm off the Ferry. So they're going to do all the distribution of all our frozen products for us, which means we can focus on the fresh product for the co-op, for our football club clients, and Joseph Holt, who we've been supplying, I think, for about 3 years now for all their pubs. So, we've grown from about 90,000 pound turnover by the pandemic ended, to potentially looking about 1.2 million next year.
Oh, brilliant.
And a big chunk of that's going to be through the co-op. Well,
many congratulations, Lee, and thank you so much for telling us, because as I said earlier on, you're an absolutely fine example of someone who went from really the bottom, the pits, to success.
Very few people that I knew 40 years ago would ever have thought that I'd be doing this now. Never thought I'd either be dead or still in jail.
And we can only hope that lots of other people take you as an example and get out of the circumstances they find themselves in, because it must have been horrid for you.
It is, and it's a very lonely path, leaving everything that I knew to be the person that I wanted to be, because there's a period where you don't fit in that world anymore, or you don't fit in the world where you want to be. And that journey between those two is a very, very lonely journey. Almost as lonely as running a small business, because you're the man at the top, and that is quite lonely as well. So a lot of my life prepared me for this and made me very, very resilient, which, again, running a small business, you have to be incredibly resilient. Again, my upbringing, if nothing, has made me unbreakable. Well, I think what's the phrase to say? Sometimes you can be broken that much that you become unbreakable.
Well, that's tough.
Well, yeah, life's good.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all that with me, Lee. I'm ever so grateful, and more power to your elbow. And I hope HM Pasties goes from strength to strength.
I'm sure we will.
Thank you ever so much.
You're welcome, Liz.
Don't go, though. I just want to say a proper thank you. Thank you. That was my formal thank you, but that's really fascinating. I mean, I happen to have a son-in-law who works in his whole aim in life is to try to prevent pupil referral units needing to exist. So yeah. He likes to work with families and children, and he will be so moved to hear your story. But I hear about a lot of young people like you were from him, obviously. And there's always a reason, always a reason.
And it's rare that you see a positive outcome as well. And particularly when you work in that sense. I mean, I worked as a mentor with young lads who would get involved in county lines, drug dealing and things like that. And all you can do as a mentor is you just hope that something you say at some point in your engagement with them penny's going to drop. You'll never be there to see that. And you just hope that 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later down the line, something you said rings true to them and it makes that impact on their life. So it's like just chucking a stone in their pond when they're a kid and just hoping that the ripple effect changes something for them later. Yeah. And that's what my second foster parents did. The damage had already been done. There's so much damage had already been done that they were fighting against that. But the man I am today is because of them, and just that 2 years that I spent with them really changed everything.
Oh, I'm so glad you had that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I made sure they knew it as well. Sadly, they're both dead now. Brian died just last week, but they knew. They knew, sure.
Good. Well, thank you ever so much. I'll let you know when it's going to be up online. It's likely to be 6 weeks or so ahead because I'm working quite far ahead at the moment. But I'll also let the co-op know, obviously, and we'll try and do some publicity and promotion around that. They're quite good at helping me when I do something to do with the co-op.
Kelly Orme will love it, and so will Rob.
I'll let her know. And who's Rob? Rob who?
Rom. I forget what Rom is for.
well, I'll ask Kelly.
Yeah, Kelly will know. Just say who's Rom. When I did my pitch, the Avery team, my upbringing was a big part of my pitch, and yeah, they were all pretty blown away by it. And Kelly, I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying, but her two daughters are adopted.
She told me, didn't she? Yes, she did. And I said I might do a podcast with her too, actually.
Yeah,
she's lovely. Great. Well, we're about to run out of time, but we've done very well. Thank you. Oh, here we go. We are running out of time. Thank you ever so much. Lovely to see you again.
And you take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.